Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Growing up in our house in Clonmensch outside of Tullamore, I began to detest that mawkish dirge about the Lake Isle of Inishfree. My grandfather, who had once visited the island, was obsessed by the poem and insisted that I recite it at every party. He even named our house after it. Later, as a young town planner, I blamed the verse for the rash of holiday homes that were beginning to appear in every beauty spot in Ireland. And I felt that it was Yeats who had provided the moral justification for this desecration. If a well-known poet could simply arise and go and build in whatever idyllic place he chose, why shouldn't everybody else? But would Yeats get planning permission? I'd put that to the test. So, never having seen Inishfree, and having no intention of ever setting foot on it, I bought an ordnance survey map and drew a traditional clay and wattled Irish cottage slap bang in the middle of the island. I surrounded it with 9 bean rows and a hive for the honeybee, or several honeybees if it came to that. I had thought of providing nests for the linnets, but not being fully au fait with the necessary ornithological arrangements, I decided to leave the linnets out. Now, in those days, there were loopholes in the Planning Act which allowed you to make an application on property which you didn't own, nor did you have to put up a site notice. So, I had all I needed to make a valid application to Sligo County Council, who would have to deal with it whether they liked it or not. I sent off my package, and having lit the blue fuse, retired to a safe distance to watch the fun. Recently, I obtained the internal reports of the council's planners dealing with the application, which were professionally objective and, surprisingly, didn't reflect the irritation of busy officials who most likely thought they had better things to be doing than dealing with a crank or a comedian. My planning application was referred to the Arts Council for advice, and its secretary, the writer Mervyn Wall, replied. He noted the similarity of my proposal to the Cemetery of Whispering Glades in Evelyn Waugh's satirical novel The Loved One, which had reserved an area containing a small cabin, bean rows and beehives solely for the interment of writers. Anticipating the ridicule which the council would endure in the event of a grant, Mervyn Wall urged the rejection of my application. 2 months later, to my delight, I received a refusal set out in impenetrable, bureaucratic planning speak. To copper fasten it, on April Fool's Day 1971, I lodged an appeal with the Minister for Local Government, and 6 months later, he turned me down too. So, having put a stop to Yeats's cabin-building ambitions, I was content at last. Long, long after I had forgotten the whole episode, the young Sligo artist Clea van der Green rang me to ask if there was any truth in the legend she had heard that someone had once tried to make Yeats's dream come true. I confessed that the opposite was the case, and thus found myself caught up with an enthusiastic group of local artists, architects and poets who wanted to honour the 150th anniversary of the poet's birth by responding in their own non-interventionist ways to his mythic island. So, on a surprisingly still and bright January day, I stood with them on the island of Inishfree for the first time. It's a tiny untouched knoll quite close to the shoreline at Loch Gill and covered in holly and oak. It rises up from the landing place on its eastern shore to a slight hill on its western and northern sides, from which stunning views up the lake towards Sligo town are revealed. It's a child's dream of a desert island, big enough to get lost in and yet small enough to be found again. From the western bluff, you can actually hear the sound of lake water lapping on the shore below. It's a very special and romantic place, and only the most insensitive developer, and certainly not a poet, would think of placing a holiday home in the middle of it. I was instantly won over and fell in love with it, as both Yeats and my grandfather once had. I don't believe for a moment that Yeats actually wanted to build a holiday home on it. Indeed, he never lived in Sligo afterwards and sensitively restored a castle in Galway. But standing on the little hill, I gave thanks for those convoluted and tortuously worded planning refusals, which had long ago conclusively protected Innisfree. We give out a lot about our planning system these days, but should we ever find ourselves in exile and far from home, we can still recite the words of the Lake Isle and know that a very special place where all our troubles will vanish is still unspoiled and still waiting for us. Just don't try to build a cabin.
I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree. 9 bean rows will I have there, and a hive for the honeybee, and a small cabin of clay and wattles made. And I will live along.
The tanks rumbled down Üllői Avenue into Budapest. Dawn was breaking. November the 6th, 1956. Only 13 days before, the small nation of Hungary had successfully revolted against Russian oppression. In Irish terms, this was Hungary's 1916. Now, the tanks bearing the capital letters CCCP of the Soviet Union were on a mission to smash this Hungarian revolution. That same day, thousands of miles away, a plane carrying the members of the Hungarian men's national water polo team touched down at Darwin, Australia. Confused and anxious for news from home, they were nonetheless determined to do their best to represent their battle-torn home country in the 1956 Olympic Games in Melbourne. Weeks before, when the revolution started, they'd been in the hills above the city of Budapest, guarded by Russian miners with no access to a pool, radio, or telephone. In the city below, fires burned, gunshots could be heard, and the players didn't know if loved ones were dead or alive. They had trained hard for 4 years. Now the trip to Australia was in jeopardy. The uncertainty was excruciating, especially for the youngest player on the team. Ervin Zádor, at 21, was a rising star in the Hungarian team. From humble beginnings, thanks to an unbeatable spirit and an exceptional swimming talent, he had worked his way up in the game. His tenacity and endurance were lauded by his more experienced Olympian teammates. As a 6-year-old, Zádor once stood in the hall of the famous Olympic swimming pool on Margaret Island in Budapest. He looked up in awe at the names of past Hungarian champions etched into a marble wall and decided that one day his name would be up there too. So when word came the Hungarian Revolution had succeeded and the team could participate in the games, Zádor was elated. They boarded a plane for Australia, exhilarated over the new independence of their country. However, their fitness level was an issue for concern. They hadn't trained in a pool for weeks. Rumors reached them en route that tanks were pouring into Hungary to reimpose Soviet rule. Immediately upon landing in Australia, the one team member who could speak English grabbed a local newspaper to find out what was happening back home. The news wasn't good. The revolution had been crushed. One dream was now shattered. The dream of an Olympic gold medal still remained. From the start of the Games, many spectators, aware of the suppressed revolution, cheered on the Hungarians. The boys delivered. The team adopted an innovative defensive strategy to compensate for the missed weeks of in-pool training. It worked. They remained undefeated up to the 6th of December 1956. On this day, the most infamous water polo match in Olympic history was to take place, the Melbourne Bloodbath. Water polo was never a game for the faint-hearted. Aggressive physicality and clever tactics make the sport gripping to watch. Kicks and punches occur regularly, especially underwater. In Hungary, huge respect persists for water polo, one of its most popular and successful sports. Exactly a month after the Russians crushed the Hungarian Revolution, the two teams that entered the pool that day were Hungary and the Soviet Union. The stage was set for a historic contest. 8,000 spectators crammed into a 6,000-seat stadium. The Russians were booed and whistled at on every touch of the ball. The crowd chanted, "Hajrá, Magyarok! Go, Hungary!" Apart from the atmosphere, the conditions for the two countries were fair and equal. The Hungarian players knew, by beating the Soviet Union, they would give a massive lift to all Hungarians. Ervin Zádor later recalled the strategy had been to provoke the Russians. "We play, they fight. Back home, we were obliged to learn 2 hours of Russian every day. So in their own language, we were able to tell them how much we disliked them. Soon, they were fighting with us. The strategy worked. With 2 minutes to go in a ferocious game, the Hungarians were leading 4-0 when Zádor got punched by his Russian marker, Valentin Prokopov. The blow created a deep cut near Zádor's right eye, which welled up with blood. Instructed to leave the pool, the injured player left a trail of bloody water behind him. Many spectators rose from their seats, demanding the game be brought to an end and that the Hungarians be declared the winners. Others clambered furiously over barriers to have a go at the Russian players. The referee halted the match a minute early, and the police had to intervene and escort the Russian players to safety. The next day, the image of Zádor's bloody face made the front pages around the world. Because of his injury, Zádor could not participate in the final against Yugoslavia. The team won 2-1, and the Hungarian water polo team were awarded gold medals. About one-third of the Hungarian Olympic delegates did not return to Hungary behind the Iron Curtain. The defectors included half of the water polo gold medalists. Zádor made it to the United States, settling in Linden, California. He never played water polo again, but coached Mark Spitz, who went on to become one of the greatest Olympic swimmers of all time. Zádor didn't see Hungary again for over 40 years. In 2002, the surviving members of both teams had an emotional reunion in Budapest. The handshake that should have taken place in 1956 in Melbourne finally happened in Budapest. They agreed that the game symbolized something much greater than the sport. Players on both teams were victims of political circumstances. It was on this visit to Hungary that the Olympians were brought back to their training pool on Margaret Island. Once again, Zádor found himself standing in the hall where he stood as a 6-year-old, looking up at the names of Hungarian champions etched into the marble wall. There, among the names of his 1956 teammates, he saw the two words, Zádor, Ervin.
What do we leave behind? Quite a lot, if you're an artist like Cliona Cusson. When Cliona died on August 1st, 2022, I was asked to speak a little on Raidan na Gaeltachta about her beginnings here in Newcastle West, a town which for some is simply on the N21, a town which commuters hope won't delay them too much as they hurry elsewhere. Of course, our sadness at the passing of a national figure was tinged with local pride, for she was of this place. This, after all, is hometown. Hometown, as in the wonderfully evocative depiction by another local, the writer Patrick J. O'Connor. Our place on the map. And when an important sculptor and Gaelic language enthusiast who started out in our hometown dies, then you're asked to stand back, to assess. And you're grateful to be asked, since her importance is both national and local. So, allowing me my parochial pride, I invite you to come with me on a little tour of hometown. We will let Cliona's work be our stalling points. Starting out from her birthplace in Gortbuí, a short walk brings us to the Pauper's Graveyard, since renamed in 1991 as the Famine Graveyard, Relling na Mocht. It is situated outside the walls of St. Ida's Hospital, which was formerly the county home and originally the Newcastle Workhouse. Cliona has depicted images of poverty on the limestone gates. You can run your hands over the famine ships, the potatoes, and, most harrowingly, feel into the marks of bare feet. While the names of most of those buried in that little field are forever lost, we note the first recorded is a Mary Lynch. Cliona has marked their lives here in this West Limerick town. She has paid her respects to Mary Lynch and all the other so-called paupers who lie within. Now let's move along down past St. Ida's Hospital, down into the town square, where this market town's dairy hinterland is remembered. See her swing into action. Colleen Des Cruyt in the Mow. She is here in the centre of what we used to call the Mall, her frock blowing in the breeze as she sets about skimming the milk for butter making. She is busy at her work, as Cliona has brought her back into life. We do not disturb her. Let's walk another 50 yards or so to the Desmond Castle, from which the town gets its name, and seated outside on his steed is Garo d'Irla, the third Earl of Desmond, and perhaps the most famous. Of Norman stock, he it was who left us the poem Margadur Gol Krishna Manoiv, Speak Not Ill of Womankind. Written in the 14th century, we remember him through his verse and associated folklore. Cliona sculpts him here, head forward, riding off into the mists of time. Folklore and history speak through the bronze work. Here's another Norman who settled and became one of our own. Next, let's grab our bikes and pedal a few miles out of town on the Cork Road and taking a right at Bannock Bridge, we soon find ourselves in the peaceful village of Broadford. One of the country's most famous 17th century poets, Dáiríre Brúidir, would have frequented this area while being entertained at nearby Springfield Castle. He has been championed by the poet Michael Hartnett, who translated much of his work. Let's recall one of Dáiríre's great lines, Marg na fuile na gov huata, meaning it would be better for him to be of little learning. He was lamenting the fall of the Irish ascendancy, which had entertained the poets at the top table. Now he was on his uppers and cast among people who had little respect for his craft. Thankfully, Cleanham was called upon, and the very fine representative piece of sculpture in the Broadford village shows two great oaks cut down with Davy in the centre. A striking image of the demise of the old order. But the poet stares out defiant. Perhaps our brother lies more peacefully now that he is commemorated here in street sculpture. Cleanna lived most of her life in Binader, Howth, County Dublin, with her husband Padraig O'Snodig, historian, language activist and publisher at Cushcame. Yet she never forgot her roots in West Limerick. She was commissioned for many works around the country, works which will stand the test of time. Others may speak of their merit, but here in her hometown she has left her mark. As we walk about Newcastle West and Broadford, she beckons to us from stone and bronze, an artist intermediary for Garrod Irla, Davy O'Bruder, and for one poverty-stricken Mary Lynch.
Many years ago, when I thought of myself as an aspiring novelist, I sat in a packed town hall in Dunleary, listening to advice and guidance from the great Maeve Binchy. She was, as ever, enlightening, entertaining, and full of encouragement. At one point, she said it was the novelist's job to study human behaviour and to gather information from any source on offer. She then asked her hundreds of listeners what they would do if they picked up a telephone and suddenly realised they were on a cross line, listening to a private conversation. A polite lady in the front row said she would immediately apologise and put the receiver down. "Absolutely right," said Maeve, and then added, "but if you are a novelist, you place your hand over the mouthpiece in case they hear your breathing. Or, better still, stop breathing altogether and you listen." These conversations, she explained, are just tiny fragments of people's lives, and it is up to us, as novelists, to fill in the full story as we imagine it. The same, she continued, is true of messages on postcards. Postcards, she explained, are just a snatch from someone's life. And as they are not sealed in envelopes, they are there for anyone to read. So we should read them. It was an inspiring, practical lecture, full of laughter. And in the years that followed, I tried to put her words and her attitude into practice. However, not having the gift, I never managed to write the novel. But I did develop a great parallel interest in buying and collecting both contemporary and vintage postcards. As my collection grew, I realised the truth in Maeve Binchy's words. Each card was indeed a glimpse into someone's life, perhaps a celebration of the present, or a hope for the future, or a comment on the past. And sometimes it would not only contain an unfinished story, but deliberately create a mysterious one. As in the intriguing card I once bought in a Belfast market that had been originally posted in London in 1906, addressed to a Miss E. M. Amies in Lowestoft in Suffolk, England. The first peculiarity about this postcard was that, apart from Miss Amies' name and address, everything else was written in code. A code that looked like a jumbled series of meaningless numbers until I realised that each number referred to a consecutive letter of the alphabet. Using this decoder, the message then read, "My dearest Ethel, thanks very much for all I received from you this morning. Will write later. I'm so busy. With best love and many kisses from your ever-loving Bill." For me, this was a message with too many unanswered questions. So I decided to further investigate by writing to the address, knowing that in the intervening century or more, the house could well have disappeared, with its generation of inhabitants long forgotten. But after a few weeks, I received a reply. The house was still there, and although the present owners had records going back to 1900, there was never any mention anywhere of Ethel Amy's. However, they knew that their attic was once a servant's quarters, with the remnants of a bell system still visible. And they suggested that perhaps Miss Amy's was an unrecorded maid or servant. They also said that the records for 1906 showed that the owner of the house was then a high-ranking sea captain whose first name was William. They delicately omitted to give his full name. So was he Bill in the postcard? And if so, why would he be writing to a maid? And why in code? And why would he say, in code, that he was so busy and would write later? Or was there another unrecorded man called Bill on the domestic staff of the house, who maybe wrote in code as a lover's joke between him and Ethel? And if that were true, what was he thanking her for, having received it that morning? And romantically or not, how did the pair of them live out the rest of their lives? I never got any answers to these questions, but I have often wondered what the true story really was. And in the absence of that, I have sometimes idly thought that maybe, just maybe, I might try to write the novel behind the story. I've yet to begin it, but I am certain that Maeve would be delighted if I did.
The artists arrive first. We thread through the circle of easels that surround the platform our model will pose on today, assessing perspectives and shadows and light. Gradually we choose positions, set out paints, pencils, canvases, notepads. Then the model enters, says good morning, slips off his robe and steps up onto the platform. He organizes himself for today's pose, one which he hopes he can sustain over long periods of time. We turn towards our easels, and in seconds, the room is silent. It's Des today, an older man, an experienced model. He likes to challenge himself in how he sits for us. He relishes twists or bends that help his still strong muscles and sinews and protrusions of bone to catch light or cast shadow. He's holding a demanding pose today, stretched out on his left side, half lying along the length of the platform, his torso pulled upwards in a sidewards curve like a supine sidewards centaur, only his elbow and lower arm on a small stool for support. It's a testing pose, weight borne only in a few places, and although there will be pauses to stretch and break for lunch, this is a long pose. It's being held for the whole day. Des will be feeling the strain before evening falls. But the artists? We're ruthless. We love this pose. The more challenging it is for Des, the more interesting it gets for us. His long legs, crossed at the ankles with a surprising elegance, his wide, solid torso, ribs arched open on one side, accordion pleated closed on the other. His dense workman's shoulders and strong neck and head all offer a rich landscape for us to explore. His body tells a story of a full life that has known both warmth and hardship. Shoulders, belly, angle of neck, drop of wrist. Every detail hints at the character life has built in him. There is something of interest at every shift of our gaze. We begin to sketch, noting as much of his balance and weight as we can in the first 20 minutes or so, because after that, Des must begin to contend with the downward pull of gravity, with the movement of blood and breath as his lungs empty and fill, with the inevitable pain that he will resist as the day goes on. At the first break, the points of contact where his limbs shape the pose on the platform are marked with tape, so that he can accurately resume the identical pose when he returns. During these rests, with masking tape indicating the outline where his body had been, the platform resembles a crime scene, as if a murder had happened here. But Des is the opposite of dead. He's a living, breathing being, and will, of course, throughout the day, move. He subtly adjusts his weight in barely perceptible micro-shifts to accommodate the passage of time. But it's a war of attrition. He simultaneously resists and surrenders to gravity. The artists also try to keep still, to maintain our unique perspectives, but we too shift and sway as hour after hour passes. At the end of the day, Des steps down from the platform, re-robes himself and walks amongst us, glancing almost shyly at the manifestations of him on each easel. Some are just like him, others more impressions of him, but in all, there's something he recognises as true. Each artist has seen him in a different light, influenced by our places in the studio and by how we experience and interpret the world. Ever a gentleman, he apologises. "I think I moved a fair bit," he says. But he didn't, not really. No more than any good model would over the course of a day's work. I tell him, "Of course you moved. You're alive. And we're life drawing." Challenging though it is to contend with the triumphs and losses of a live model, it may be that very dynamic that fuels our labours. In battling to hold such a pose, Des battles gravity, time, and yes, death. He is Cuchulainn fighting the waves, and we at our easels fight them too. We're hoping to catch lightning in a bottle, to catch not just a likeness, but also, somehow, a life force. It may be that as we draw Des's resistance to the earth, we also draw from it, his struggle a conduit for our own. It may be that we're trying, as poets have put it, to sing for every tatter in its mortal dress, to rage, rage against the dying of the light, and to glimpse the immortal diamond that is the mortal one.
Whatever about parts of Eastern Europe, it's a long time since Ireland was as densely covered in trees as it often appears in myth and legend. Even so, there are evenings when the light is just right, and even a walk in a North Dublin park can bring us face to face with that parallel dimension. It was about this time last year, early in the evening and turning cool, and my grown-up son and I were out to tire the dog and make the most of the extended daylight. Now and then we stopped along the way to listen to the eerie cawing and gurgling sounds of the nesting herons in that great Gothic cathedral of cypress trees above our heads. And at one point noticed a little ahead of us, in off the path, a young girl, 10 or 11 years of age at most, and a few metres beyond her, a woman of my own age, with an unmistakable look of concern in her expression. Despite the lack of resemblance between the two at first, I took it as some mother-daughter conversation, or negotiation, more likely. The kind I'd normally pass with a sympathetic smile, one parent to another. But then I spotted something unusual in the girl's folded arms. Grey-white, the size of a bag of flour or slightly bigger. But too still, too upright to be a dog. And then my eyes picked out the yellow webbed tarsi, as the feet are properly called, the long toes wrapped tight around her wrist as any bracelet. The girl was clutching a heron chick, beautiful and ungainly, fallen almost certainly from the canopy 10 or 15 metres above our heads. The scene was something from a medieval painting. This dark-haired, dark-eyed, dark-clothed girl, strangely impassive and distinctly otherworldly. And in her arms, the hunched, almost luminous form of the bird, its heart beating visibly, in profile, its one exposed yellow eye intently alert. Passing the dog on the leash back to my son, I approached. The woman, a local, as it turned out, informed me that she'd only just then come upon the girl, and was, of course, with dogs everywhere and soon, no doubt, foxes and who knows what else, reluctant to leave her there. And thus began our encounter with the mythic. Despite her lack of English, it soon became clear that the girl was from Ukraine and, staying somewhere in the area, had wandered into the park alone, as children do in fairy tales, only to find in the early summer undergrowth a trembling creature as vulnerable as herself. We consulted our phones, scrolled through Google Maps, searching for a landmark the girl might recognise. A church, a school, a playground. And after a while, though less than convinced, we settled on a plan, forming ourselves into a motley caravan, a procession of wonder and hope. The girl who'd rescued the bird. The woman who'd rescued the girl. And the man, his son, and their puzzled, patient dog, blindly leading the way. As it happened, though we walked together for no more than a few minutes, it was as if we'd known each other all our lives, all falling into the same hypnotic rhythm. The woman told how she'd spent the previous months caring for a relative who died only weeks before. How her world since then had been turned upside down. And I told about my own Uncle Peter, 100 years of age the month before, in a nursing home just minutes up the road, beginning to see as we walked how hurt and rescue are so often drawn to one another. Before we knew it, we'd reached a nondescript house, a limp Ukrainian flag above the door. I knocked. Relief, surprise, confusion. The emotions that crossed the face of the woman who answered are the same in all languages and none. And when the girl's even younger siblings and cousins appeared, the excitement was electric, rejuvenating. shared as it was between returned sister, victim bird, and hero dog. In short, and who knows if it was the best idea, but the heron chick spent that night as a refugee among refugees. A length of string looped around its leg to keep it from trying to fly indoors and injuring itself. And early next morning, as we assured her mother we would, my son and I returned, collected girl and bird, and drove to the local vet, though it was never clear to any of us what a vet might be able to do in the circumstances. And perhaps it was better not to know. But so it is with fairy tale and myth. Often there are more questions than there are answers. And yet, despite the odds, magical things do happen. And when darkness falls, and tired eyes or tired wings fold shut, night is a forest again, haunted and strange, and a child is the last hope of a broken world.
On this morning's programme, we heard Building a Small Cabin by Fergal McCabe, Blood in the Water by Bernadette Buda, The Sculptor Leaves Her Mark was by Mike McDonnell, Novel Suggestions by Bernard Farrell, Life Drawing by Sharon Hogan, and A Walk Under Trees by Pat Boren. The music this morning, The Lake Isle of Innisfree by The Waterboys from their album An Appointment with Mr. Yeats. Tovasi Sel, Spring Breeze, a traditional Hungarian folk song sung by Erzsébet Turok with Ferenc Farkas on piano. Martin Mulvihill's Reel, played on fiddle by Matt Kranich. Telephone and Rubber Band by the Penguin Cafe Orchestra, and Yeats' The Pity of Love, set to music by Raymond Driver and sung by Ashley Davis. The Tread Softly Festival in Sligo is celebrating W.B. Yeats throughout August, and there are lots of events, exhibitions and workshops to enjoy. They have a website, treadsoftly.ie, and you'll get details there. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And if you'd like to listen back to this morning's programme, you can do that on the RTE radio app.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.